Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the third episode of my series of weekly 50-minute podcasts. Wild Trekker is a writer's notebook consisting of audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions with wonderful musicians, mail from listeners, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. Today's episode starts off with one of the most moving interviews I've ever conducted. Brian Keenan, the Northern Irish author, was kidnapped by Shiite terrorists in Beirut, Lebanon, on April 11, 1986, and released close to 4 years later, on August 24, 1990. I meet Brian in a pub in Dublin. After the interview, he invites me to hoist a pint of Guinness in one pub after the other. I forget how many exactly. So after playing the interview for you in this podcast, I then reflect on what he tells me, based on my own work as a freelance journalist, on assignment for CBC TV, investigating hostage takings in Lebanon.
Testing 1, 2.
Don't be expecting the same back.
Okay, so I hear... What is the name of this pub again?
It's called McDade's. It's just off Grafton Street in the heart of Dublin. It's a famous pub, one of the literary water holes in days gone past. Men like famous poet Patrick Kavanagh would have drank in here. Brendan Behan was a frequenter. And other names, which would be in the canon of Irish literature... came here to argue and fight the toss and down pints. It hasn't changed since those days, though few literary figures call in now. I think they've all kind of moved out of the city to wherever they go.
So I'm sorry to put these to you again, but... while you were in captivity, you were thinking a lot about things that you would do once you were free. Or were you finding freedom and some kind of personal dignity while you were being held captive in Lebanon?
I never thought much about being free. I chose not to think much about outside. Very, very early in my captivity, I decided that this was my life, this 6-foot by 4-foot. Cell was where I was, and that was my reality, and one that I had to deal with, to dwell on things outside of that, prolong the time. And time was dreadful enough. I remember spending much time trying to kill time, that kind of absurdity. Time is something you cannot kill, nor slaughter, nor murder. But you can make it more hurtful and painful if you try to dwell outside the reality you're confined in. So I didn't make future plans. Not least because some of my friends were murdered a couple of cells down from me. There was no card outside my door saying release date. So why dwell on what is only an aberration of mind?
Did you have any contact with Arab hostages?
No direct contact. I knew that there were other people there who were local because of their language and because of the way, when they were being tortured, you know, this wasn't misinformation being fed to me by captors. people who are being tortured scream out in their own native tongue, and you know exactly the nationality of the people on the floor above you, where the torture room was. But I had no contact with them in that day. Would probably have had very little English anyway. And what Arabic I had, I was not prepared to tell my guards I had any.
You mentioned in your book, In Evil Cradling, that you felt torture was like a form of rape.
Yeah, well, it is, because bruises and bloody marks go away, but something that invades your dignity leaves scars that time don't heal, and you have to be very careful not to allow that to happen. So although there was no kind of physical rape, because there would never have been in any case, because nobody's going to allow that to happen. And you maintain a sense of your own identity and who you are, which I think the Arab mind understands that and gets quite frightened of it. And after all, I'm Irish, I'm stubborn.
Did you feel at times that you had a kind of heightened consciousness when you were held captive, held hostage in Lebanon?
Absolutely, because those 4.5 years in small, tiny, dark rooms with a blindfold on, sometimes not being fed for a long time, and permanently on an 18-inch long piece of chain, is a very heightened reality. And consequently, your mind works with that very heightened capacity. And through it, it takes you to very, very strange places, some of them quite hurtful. Some of them very, very hard to deal with, but also it provides a means of escape, of egress out of that confinement and out of all that horror, as if part of yourself can slip away through the chinks in the brickwork and be somewhere else. You have to come back, and that's the difference. Didn't Freud talk about define insanity as... a flight from a terrible traumatic reality and the refusal to return. I had to return, because you have to live in the reality and you have to use the capacity, the very heightened capacity of escape that the imagination in its flight provides for you.
Did you sometimes feel that the roles were reversed, that the captors were in fact slaves and that you, albeit a hostage, were somehow able to leave your imprint of personal dignity or freedom?
I'm quite sure that happened at some time during those 4.5 years. Something happens where it's almost like the roles reverse, that the captors become the captives. It's perhaps got something to do with these guys are with you 24 hours a day, and it's as if they witness something that they become afraid of, some kind of, as if you give off some kind of psychic discharge, which they understand and are afraid to deal with. And if they do deal with it, they can only deal with it aggressively, because they're afraid of it. And that's what they understand. They equate aggression with fear, so you should be afraid of them if they're violent to you. But I think it's as if they tune in almost unconsciously to this kind of psychic discharge to give, and they get very afraid of it. And in a kind of sense, they, if you like, unconsciously worship it. And that's when you become most free, because you don't really care whether they come in to shoot you or beat you up or torture you or whatever, because you're not afraid of that anymore, because your mind is on another place. It's on fire, and the radiating heat of it keeps those who want to destroy you away from you.
So at some point, you and your cellmate, John McCarthy, decided to start a yak farm in Patagonia.
Yeah, well, we had this kind of strategy to help us get through the day, where you had to choose a part of the world as your own and then explain why you chose that part of the world. McCarthy, in one of his lunatic moments, chose the Caribbean. And when I asked him why did he want the Caribbean, he said in a kind of his mock East London accent, "I want to roof it," which meant that he wanted to put a roof over it. Why anybody would want to put a roof over the Caribbean was kind of lunatic enough notion to have me in hysterics for a few days. So I had to better that. And when he said, "Well, where do you want?" I said, "Just, I don't know where it came from." I said, I'm going to have Patagonia. And they looked at me. And I thought Patagonia was somewhere near Siam, wherever that was, because I associate it with Yul Brynner and that film he made. So I hadn't a clue where Patagonia was, but I had to justify going there. And I told him that I wanted to start a yak farm, to which he looked at me wide-eyed and said, "A fucking yak farm? What the fuck are you going to do?" And so this went on to a lot of abuse about why I wanted a yak farm in Patagonia. And for 6 weeks, I explained in great detail how this could be meaningful and constructive and how I could spend the rest of my liberated years, if I had any, as the best, greatest yak farmer in all the world in Patagonia. Well, that passed the time for about 6 weeks. I think I had McCarthy believing that it was really possible.
One of the great writers about Patagonia, W.H. Hudson, wrote about the two natures of humans. And he felt that he really tapped into those two natures in Patagonia above all other places. He wrote, "Doubtless man is naturally scientific and finds out why things are not what they seem and gets to the bottom of all mysteries. But his older, deeper, primitive, still persistent nature is non-scientific and mythical. And in spite of reason, he wonders at the change. It is a miracle, a manifestation of intelligent life and power that is in all things." Now, he was a scientist, but he was also an artist, and he was a Darwinian, but he was also an animist. What do you think about that?
I can go along with most of what he said. I'm not scientific, but have, like himself, have the curious mind of anyone, why things work and how they work and what's the relationship. But I'm a person who's drawn to wilderness and barren places. Because I believe, and my experience of these places is that there is some kind of deeply penetrating primitive animism that of itself, if you're prepared and courageous enough, I suppose, to surrender to it, holds up in that wilderness, whether it's in the wilderness of Patagonia, whether it's in the wilderness of Arctic Alaska, where my last book was about, holds up as if a mirror into your soul or your spirit, if you're religious. I'm not particularly. But I find that in these places, I can enter into a landscape of profound understanding and illumination, a lucidity of mind and emotion that I can find nowhere else. And perhaps that relates to my time being locked up in a dark hole in the ground, that I find that kind of release there and only there. And haven't found it since. I don't find it in this city. I don't find it in religion. The confines of a cathedral are just that to me. They don't bring me to any encounter with anything powerful, omniscient, or, I don't know, a nearness to something that is pre-rational and beyond our understanding, but which is a profoundly powerful engagement. Sometimes I find in this encounter with this primitive animism, to be prepared to meet it and to take from it what it brings you. You have to wear, if you like, a kind of asbestos suit, because it will change you, and the illumination that it will burn into your psyche or your consciousness or your emotional persona is one that will mark and change you forever.
Now, you wrote in your book about Patagonia with John McCarthy that you didn't really understand why some people want to be slaves.
Well, I think I think people are slaves because they choose to be. There's a kind of safety, isn't there, in being confined in knowing things. You know, most people are afraid of the unknown and don't want any encounter or don't want to have to deal with it. Like Hudson says, as a scientist, we like to know things and how they work. Unknown things terrify us. So most people, I find, are content with an unconscious slavery, to live in a known reality which doesn't threaten, doesn't force change, doesn't require them to enter into the wildness that is at the heart of their being and who they are and where they meet themselves. I personally, my own experience is that I'm a kind of an anarchist. Well, I'm not a kind of a one. I am, and I believe that the true state of what we are as human beings is being absolutely free, because it's only in that sense of absolute freedom can we come to terms with who we are, with what we want, and can we ever achieve what is in us all to achieve. Most people don't want that kind of, to take that omniscience onto themselves, because it's frightening and it's terrifying. And who wants to live in that? So they choose a kind of unconscious slavery because it's more comfortable. To me, I think it's a kind of the antithesis of what we are as human beings. We are not slave creatures. We are free, absolutely free. And to live without freedom is to live in chains. And I've been there. I've been in chains for a long time. I don't wish it on anybody. But I've been and have a profound, I think, well, for myself, no understanding of what is in us. You know, and we should not be afraid. And the only way we can encounter that free being that we are is to not live under the confines or dictates or follow or run after the coattails of anybody else.
I felt when we interviewed Nabi Berri, who's terrorist-in-chief of the Amal militia at the time, when I was with the CBC in Lebanon several years ago, that much as I was scared to be in the no man's land where he lived, in the last standing building surrounded by rubble, he himself was probably the most terrorized person I've ever seen. And although he commanded militia which had fought a war against the PLO, and he was responsible ultimately for many thousands of deaths and kidnappings and all kinds of other things, he himself was completely terrorized and expected that he would be blown up at any moment, even by ourselves interviewing him.
I'm sure that that's quite true. I mean, that's my experience of Lebanon when I was there teaching there, that it's a world consumed in fear. And I suppose people just choose to exist in that, you know. Survival is the means that they get by on. Liberation is not part of their theology of life or their philosophy of life. And maybe when you choose to set yourself up as a leader and have as the medals on your chest or your credentials for leadership, you know, the number of people you have murdered, assassinated, are being responsible for, yeah, you'll have all those ghosts standing behind your back for the rest of your life, and they'll never leave you alone. And those who live by that know that, and they're never going to admit it. And the terrible thing is that these great leaders are going to die very frightened, terrified men.
Back to Patagonia, could you tell me a little bit about your experiences with horses? Did you find they were smarter than you were sometimes, or did you grow in your appreciation of horses as time went on?
I hadn't ridden a horse since I was a young man trying to impress young women a long time ago in Belfast. I became quite a good wasso, as it's called in Chile. I'd went out for 3 months to learn how to ride before the long journey into Patagonia. And I became reasonably competent. And when you ride a horse over the top of the Andes and back again, you kind of, you have to be in some way confident, but you also have to have confidence in the fellow creature whose back you're sitting on. I can remember one part of the trip riding along this narrow pathway. Now, there are no bridle paths at the top of the Andes, and either side of this 2 feet wide pathway, the land dropped away, sheer drop, some 3,000 feet, most of which I think I just rode along with my eyes closed until we came to a break on which the horse had to jump over, and it was a gap of about 3 foot. My horse was called Rabbit by sheer coincidence, and I just closed my eyes, kicked its flanks, and Rabbit jumped across that chasm of chaos and landed me safely on the other side. I was not so kind of quick to condemn Rabbit after that and put an awful lot of faith in it. Say that horses have small brains, maybe they have, but I had a terrifyingly small brain as well. Like I could have quite happily disappeared into the earth, because I'm terrified of heights.
Now, part of your idea with John McCarthy was to set up a yak farm. How did that project develop as time went on?
Well, it was a lunatic notion that we kind of talked about and went off to Chile with this idea of maybe finding, was there a possibility? But as the journey began, travelling through Chile, I was more interested in the politics of Chile and the years of the disappeared and the Pinochet regime. And I have a great love of Pablo Neruda, who I think is perhaps one of the few poets of international status, who is also a historian, a philosopher, and an artist, and who makes a synthesis of all these in his work. And I tried to see through the eyes of Neruda the Chile, which had touched my own youthful growing up in troubled parts of Belfast. I would read of the kind of atrocities of the Pinochet regime. So when I went out there, the whole idea of a yak farm, because I knew it was a lunacy, you know, invented out of a lunatic imagination in Lebanon. And as we progressed through Chile from the Atacama Desert down to Terra del Fuego, the whole notion kind of washed itself away as we encountered the reality and as I tried to see with Neruda's eyes. But then, when we were high in the mountains, I remember coming out of a glade of autumnal trees and coming out into this open valley, and there was the remnants of a kind of hill farm where farmers who reared vicuna for their wool would have brought the vicuna down from the mountains to keep them in these low-lying pastures, still up in the foothills. And as the horse came out of the glade and I saw this thing instantaneously into my head, said, there it is. Holy fuck, this is it. This is it. This is the farm. This is where the yak farm is. And it wasn't a kind of joke anymore. It was, you know, where the fairy tale and all the magic becomes real, where miracles manifest themselves in a reality. And I remember looking at McCarthy and saying nothing. And he looked back and he knew exactly what was in my head, you know. So maybe if you fabricate dreams and make yourself believe them for 6 weeks, you create a reality which becomes real. And the yak farm existed and it was waiting on us. And there it was. And we found it.
Did Alfonso ever go ahead with it?
I don't know, but I have been back. I've been back to do a programme with the BBC about Chile and the politics of Neruda and Pinochet. And I met Alfonso again. I don't think he ever did. The whole complications of... Although it's a grant system in Chile that if you bring in an animal other than a native animal to farm, there are substantial grants or wars from the Chilean government. But I don't think... I think the whole idea intrigued Alfonso because he had that kind of... he had that kind of lunatic imagination. But I suppose the mechanics of doing it were quite impossible. And anyway, he owns, I don't know, 1.5 million hectares and hundreds and thousands of sheep. And I suppose that's enough to deal with.
I felt in your book that on Patagonia that... you were drawing parallels now and then between Lebanon and Chile. And one of the things that really changed through the book was your growing understanding of how Chileans had grieved for the many disappeared, the thousands and thousands of people who'd been kidnapped, snatched, taken by the fascist government of Pinochet, and how they had tried to cope with their own ambivalence and their own anguish, but also saying to themselves, where do we go from here? How do we keep the country together in a way?
I think that's quite true. And I think quite a lot of Chileans, particularly when you go into the villages outside of Santiago and speak to people, they will all have an uncle or a brother or a cousin or a sister or an aunt who have been disappeared. And that anguish will hang over them for the rest of their lives, as it will anyone who disappeared, you know, anyone who lost family in the Holocaust still talk about it. And they are the same ghosts the ghosts that hunt people like Nabi Berry. There are still ghosts who hang about and need to be brought home. It's terribly difficult to do so, but I remember one woman who touched me deeply. She had lost two sons. And when I who had been disappeared, presumably as she knows, murdered and buried somewhere she doesn't know. Probably bulldozed into a hole in the ground somewhere. And when I asked her about it, she said her answer was very simple and quite profound. She said, that was another time. And I thought there was so much grace in that statement. And I was so deeply moved by it that it was another time. And then her own way, she would carry and care for and nurture her dead sons as long as she was alive, even if she never saw them again, because she never let go of them, but was prepared to make this kind of huge psychological movement in herself, that that was another time. And when people talk like that, hope and history do rhyme, and they do make some kind of sense.
Did you find Patagonia was a place where you could be comfortable with silence and with your own solitude?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there is such a thing as silence. I think when you go into these barren and remote extremes of the earth, the silence is not so silence, it's full, it's almost orchestral. There's a kind of a harmony or a melody that kind of envelops you and swirls around you, and it takes you into this empty space, which is never empty. There's no such thing as emptiness. And I think in those empty, silent spaces, they're the words of the stranger who has not entered in. And travel, when you go to a place, you can travel through it or you can pass through it, but you will take nothing from it. But in the wilderness, you have to pass into it. And there isn't any such thing as silence. I've stood in places where no human being has probably been, probably in millenniums. And I have never heard silence. I've heard an orchestra so, if you like, a kind of esoteric that opens up vistas within yourself and lets you walk into them. And without being in that place, without being in that noisome silence, I would never find that doorway into myself, into that other landscape.
Patagonia, the dream that Brian Keenan nurtured, the fantasy that kept him alive through 4 years of living hell, the wide open country under a brilliant blue sky, the horses beating the ground with their hooves and picking their way across mountain streams. Ah, liberty. One thing really strikes me about the interview with Brian Keenan, his ability to put into words what it feels to be neither alive nor dead, because that is the daily experience of hostages who are wrapped tightly in packing tape, thrust into the secret compartments of trucks to be shipped from Beirut to points east, who are occasionally chained to pipes and beds and even held in the cupboards of private homes for years at a stretch, who are disoriented suddenly when they are released after a few years in the shadows. I found when investigating hostage takings in the Middle East that I was struggling with conventional wisdom, because I learned on the ground so many things that were simply not reported in Western media. For example, this was not a conflict pitting Christians against Muslims. There were Muslim victims as well, and a so-called Christian militia could be just as bloodthirsty as any Shiite Muslim militia. Many Western authorities said kidnappings were usually claimed by terrorist groups. So if there was no claim, then there was not really a hostage. They also said there were no women hostages. But in my experience, this turned out to be completely false. Many experts in the West said there was a strict distinction between political and non-political hostages. But I found hostage taking is a very dark kind of business transaction, where every person taken captive is worth something and can be traded against hostages held by other militias or even held for ransom. I sometimes heard random machine gun fire in Beirut. The civil war was now over, and people said to me, oh no, it's just militiamen with Kalashnikovs celebrating some birthday party or other. I have a dream. I'm walking alone in the rubble of West Beirut, when two uniformed Shiite militiamen, one redhead and the other with sweaty black curls, begin running after me, waving Kalashnikovs. I run before them, searching in vain for a place to hide. Finally, I come upon a store offering maternity dresses with bright pink and blue ribbons. Behind the counter is a lovely dark-haired woman, a real Mediterranean beauty, who says, what do you want? You must hide me, I yell. Quick, they're coming after me. Come with me, she says, beckoning me to a closet, where she pulls aside some clothes to reveal a secret trapdoor and pushes me downward into a safe, womb-like enclosure. No sooner has she pulled the trapdoor shut over my head than I hear the two militiamen burst into the shop, screaming, where is he? Where have you hid the American? What are you talking about? She yells back, defiantly. Nobody has come to my shop for weeks now. Look about you in the street. You men with your torture and rape and murder, you've ruined the street. There's no life left here at all. You should be ashamed at all that you have destroyed. Now leave this shop at once. I look about me in my hiding place. The earth floor is uneven, sloping to one side. It smells of humidity and crawling things. There's a light bulb with a bed chain dangling from it. I switch it on and see shelves of all the books I've always wanted to read, but never had time to. On the round wooden table stands a glass pitcher of water for me, with beads of condensation dribbling down its side. I've become a fetus again. An adult fetus. I awake in a panic, sweating profusely. Well, in reading Brian Keenan's book, An Evil Cradling, I'm astonished to find that he had a very similar dream, like a birth in reverse, returning to the womb to be protected from all the horrors that he was experiencing during his everyday life in Beirut. At a certain point, the horror hits you like a sledgehammer. Everyone has lost someone. Every building bears the scars of hatred and rocket attacks. The center of Beirut is like a paranoid world of apocalyptic ruins, where squatters warm their hands over campfires in the ghostly shadows. But there were actually still several hundred hostages held in 27 different detention centers in the Bekaa Valley of central Lebanon. Everyone is afraid that knowing you, telling you the secrets of guilt and destruction, will cost them their lives. I went jogging one morning along rows of umbrella pines and cypress trees, but it took all the fun out of jogging when I had to stop at regular Syrian roadblocks every 100 meters, where 10 soldiers with Sylvester Stallone biceps and tiny heads pointed their Kalashnikovs over the sandbags at me. I felt I was passing through a sort of glass wall, separating the convenient little fictions we like to tell ourselves and the dark knowledge of terror. I learned how much powerful people will lie to cover themselves. I learned the limits of love and compassion. I learned what risk is. I learned the satisfaction, but also the cost, of living according to my conscience. In Beirut, I didn't save anyone's life except, perhaps, my own. I spat in the devil's face and lived to tell the story. And when it was time to leave, I got safely away. I mentioned it in a recent blog on Evidencia.net, A Secret Garden, that we were working on a documentary about hostages, and this assignment put my life at risk since we were pressing warlords on camera for answers about the fate of hostages, warlords running their own private armies. I could easily have become a disappeared person myself. This assignment put my value system at risk, my faith and trust and optimism. I wrote the following poem in French after returning home. If you don't understand it, then wait a bit and I'll give you an English translation. Il y a dans mon cœur un lieu secret. Je l'ai regagné à 4h10. Redessinant dans la froideur de la nuit, comme sur un tableau lumineux, toute la douceur des premiers jours. La surface ondulante me berce, la pagaie laissant goûter une traînée de tourbillons qui gargouille et glisse et chuinte. Le kayak s'approche d'une image floue et blanche, d'un être vivant, mystérieux, qui danse sur l'eau, d'une multitude qui murmure et gémit et remue. Les oies des neiges se sont arrêtées durant leur migration vers le sud, entre l'austère baie de Pawhunituk et les pins chuchotants de la Caroline. Le kayak me projette dans ce tableau d'automne, tout bordé d'écarlate et d'or, de couleurs figées. Le temps s'est arrêté. Et dans ce lieu secret, l'effroi s'évanouit. L'âme quitte les visions d'horreur, les décombres des trous de balles, les enlèvements de Beyrouth que je suis venu documenter, la tempête des folies humaines, la haine du dieu des entonnoirs. J'ai voulu prendre la mesure du monde, offrir mon témoignage du bien et du mal, mais ce jeu de contraste ne mène nulle part. Des fois, le mal est une façon plus qu'un absolu. Longtemps, les oies subissent-elles mon regard, et puis, le vent se levant doucement, d'un commun accord, elles s'étirent, se rangent en V, éclaboussant la surface du bout des ailes, et lentement, tout en caquetant, prennent leur envol. Il y a dans mon cœur un lieu secret où la beauté côtoie l'innocence. J'y retourne souvent. There is in my heart a secret place. I went back there at 4:10, calling forth in the coolness of night, as if drawing on a crystal clear screen, all the sweetness of the first days. The undulating surface rocks me. My paddle leaves a swirling trail of gurgling bubbles, slipping and hissing. The kayak approaches a blurred white image, a living, mysterious being. Dancing on the water, murmuring, cackling, stirring. A flock of snow geese rests here, on their migration southwards, from the austere bay of Pawhunituk to the whispering pines of Carolina. The kayak glides into this autumn scene, all bordered with scarlet and gold. The colors are frozen. Time has stopped. And in this secret place, I find release from my dread and visions of horror. The broken rubble and bullet-scarred buildings, the kidnappings of Beirut I've come to document, the storm of human follies, the hatred of God of the bomb craters. I wanted to take the measure of the world, bear witness to good and evil, but stark either-or choices lead nowhere. Sometimes evil is a manner, more than something absolute. For the longest time, the geese suffer my gaze, and then, the wind slowly rising, they respond to some secret stirring, stretch their wings, lining up in a V, splash the surface with their wingtips. Slowly, honking, they take flight. There's in my heart a secret place where beauty and innocence find each other. I go back there often. So I would really recommend to you two books in particular by Brian Keenan. One is An Evil Cradling, the most remarkable book that I've ever read about hostages. And the second is Between Extremes, a book Brian Keenan wrote with his fellow cellmate John McCarthy once they were freed and got that opportunity finally to visit the Patagonia of their dreams. If you'd like to know more about my creative works, check out my author's website, www.evidencia.net. And that's Evidencia, E-V-I-D-E-N-T-I-A. There you'll find information about my forthcoming feature film, The Blinding Sea, and about a few forthcoming books and book translations, as well as my blogs, like A Secret Garden, the poem about my experience of Lebanon and then the healing power of nature, and of course, Wild Trekker, this podcast series. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2019, George Toombs, all rights reserved. Let's get together soon. Bye for now.